Rebel Moon Part 2 has arrived, and if extended slow motion montages of harvesting grains sound like a good time, then you're in for a treat. I'd love to say it's got surprises, but this bloated, soulless mess is exactly what you think it is. Welcome everyone to the Atomic Cinema Experiment. I am Peter, and I am ready to jump off a bridge. How about you, David?
Well, I usually come in peace, but as I think the last time we talked about part one, I'm ready for war. I'm angry. I'm ready to fight.
Part one, of course, that David is referring to is Rebel Moon Part 1, and today we are here, sadly, to talk about Rebel Moon Part 2, which I was dreading watching, honestly. I could have started watching this like 3 hours before I did, and I just kept pushing it and pushing it. And then once I did put it on, like, I swear, the mix of feelings that were, one, I don't want to do this, and two, I really was struggling to pay attention for the first like 20 minutes where I was just, my eyes kept wandering. I kept looking at different things. I kept wanting to pick up the phone. I kept wanting to just do anything to distract from the movie that I did not want to watch. And then on top of all that, there was a lot of, so what was this character's deal in the last movie? Because I'm struggling with that. But we'll get into all those things. But yes, this is, of course, Zack Snyder's movie. This is the second part of what was clearly meant to be one big movie that was split in two. So we're going to talk about it. This is Rebel Moon Part 2, The Scar Giver, to give its full title.
Now, without looking at anything, can you remember Part 1's subtitle?
Trail to Fire.
Good job. You did it.
Yeah. Now ask me to name a single character.
Oh, God, no. I wouldn't dare ask that.
Tell you right now, I can't do it.
You were saying how hard you were finding it to struggle to just pay attention and how hard to start the movie and all that. And I agree. I think that it was something that I had trouble really paying attention to. But I want to make clear up front, before we even begin, how much I tried to play ball with this movie. How much I really, really tried to get on this movie's level in terms of how I think they would want me to experience it. So, Peter, I watched part one again.
You stupid son of a bitch.
Now, in fairness, I watched it through at 1.5 speed, so I didn't have to do like the full commitment. But I did watch through part one again, just so I could fully understand like the characters and what they were doing and like all of that.
Just on the 1.5 speed, I have to comment how much of the movie will be them playing at normal speed.
Yes, it is.
And some of it will still be too slow because it went ultra slow-mo numerous times, if I recall correctly.
Oh, yeah, no, it was weird during all the fight scenes because there were parts where everyone's moving quickly and then they're moving normally, but then they're moving slower again. And I'm like, I have no idea what the normal speed is anymore.
Wild. That's just a funny thought as soon as you said that. So we're going to start spoiler-free, of course. Not that there's that much to spoil, to be honest, but we'll start spoiler-free, we'll give you a warning for greatest spoilers, and just before we do start talking about the movie proper, I'll just remind you, if you're enjoying the show on YouTube, please do hit the like button, it helps us out a bunch if you do, and of course you can get some bonus monthly shows that me and David do over at patreon.com/mailfuzzTV, but I'll tell you more about that at the end of the show. So, the plot of this like two-part movie is that it's seven samurai in space, and the first part was effectively just the collecting of all the different warriors that will help defend the village. They kind of had a big action scene that kind of felt like it was maybe a third act action scene. And this part of the story, this second half, is the actual them in the village and they're preparing for the big fight that's coming. A cynical person might say that this is a third act of a movie spread out over 2 hours of runtime.
Thank God we're not cynical people, right, Pete?
Well, it's funny, because if you actually think about Seven Samurai, they get back to the village at the end of Act 1, give or take. Mm-hmm. And that's fine, too, because they spend a lot of time with the relationships with the people in the village, and the trials and tribulations. There's a lot more problem-solving about, okay, how do we actually defend this village, and so on, so on. Mm-hmm. I'm about to describe about a 15 to 20-minute portion of this movie, right? All and right. This, I swear, is accurate. We're going to watch a montage in slow motion of the harvesting of grain. I'm not done.
Okay. All right.
We're watching a slow motion montage of the harvesting of grain, of farmers cutting at the wheat or whatever, all that. We're going to do all that for like 5 minutes with inspirational music playing. It sounds like, it almost sounds like the song from like the Gladiator score where you've got the woman singing over it kind of thing.
With how much like hands are running over wheat, I swear to God, this was just Gladiator.
Right? We then cut to the villain's spaceship. We have a scene with the villain, right? Mm-hmm. We cut back to the planet. We get another 5 minutes of slow motion montage of them at the next stage of the harvesting of the grain, where literally the character who's very clearly based on Katana from DC Comics starts throwing grains into the air in ultra slow motion. We cut back to the villain's spaceship. We get a scene with the villain and what they're planning to do. We cut back to, I shit you not, a slow motion montage of them moving around sacks of grain and pouring it into sacks. You know, the final part of the process. And this was the moment where I about lost my goddamn mind. I'm like, you've now done three montages back to back, just separated by other scenes with a different plot line of just the harvesting of the grain. That's what you have spent 15 to 20 minutes of this 2 hour runtime doing, and you're telling me you couldn't trim all this down into one 2 hour movie, you sack of shit? Because I don't believe you.
There's a character in this movie who is like a master strategist, and he says with a straight face as they are talking about this giant armada coming down to their village, our wheat is our strength, our farming is our battle. And I just stopped. Like my life, every bit of iota I could care about this movie just stopped right there. And then the sequence you described happened, and I was happy that I stopped there.
It's the sort of thing where, in some ways, this one is, I don't know, like, in some ways, the simplicity of them just waiting for the attack and then warding off the attack and that being pretty much the whole movie, like, makes it less annoying, I guess, than the first part. But at the same time, the padding feels even more extraneous in this one. And I was feeling it repeatedly through, like, I mean, even, like, the training montage stuff. There's a point where they're like, hey, we're going to teach you how to use a machete to, like, swing it at limbs. They've got, like, sort of straw scarecrow thing set up. And it's just people going up and whacking off, like, some straw with a machete. And I'm like, there's no skill in this. Like, they didn't have to be taught how to swing a machete. Like, I get, obviously, training them how to hold a gun properly and fire it so they can actually hit a target, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But do you know what may have been effective in that scene? Maybe showing one of the farmers failing to do it. Every single farmer we see try to fire the gun, they do it and immediately just like blow off the head of a dummy.
They had exactly that one person who came up to the gun, their elbow was out, like way far like that. And then Cora comes up and just taps it down. And then all of a sudden, everyone else is perfect at shooting. We never get to see another person even slightly messed up.
Yep. Yeah, I cannot believe how thin and how little this movie actually has in terms of plot. There's things that they kind of set up in the last movie that felt like, well, I guess that's going to be a bigger thing in part two, and I couldn't believe how small some of those things were in this.
Absolutely.
I won't say anything about it yet, but the robot, like, there's basically nothing.
I remember I was pissed at how they handled the robot in the last movie. Because it just, like, it seemed like they were setting him up for a thing, and then, like, the very last shot was, oh, look, the robot's still here. And it was like, oh, okay, well, I guess it's going to be a part two. Part two rolls around. Oops, we forgot to record Anthony Hopkins' lines. Guess we'll just shove him off to the side for a little longer then.
And I'm starting to regret saying this one is arguably the least offensive of the two, because I just remembered another bit that really pissed me off. It's like, so along with the wasting time of all the extraneous montages of grain, like, because that's the thing, he's like, hey, we're going to like harvest all the grain in 3 days, which is a ridiculous amount of time, but that gives us a couple of days to just focus on prepping for you know, the defense and all that and blah blah blah. And it's like, okay, fine. But then they focus so heavily on just watching them do that in slow motion. It's like, this is ridiculous. The other thing that felt like a huge time waste to me, and especially, I mean, even from, like, partly time waste, but even more so than the time wasting, is just how poor, from a structure point of view, this really irked me, was we get, like, flashbacks with backstory for, like, four of the warriors in the same scene, back to back to back to back. And they're all full of slow motion. Like, it was making me cackle with, like, laughter. Not in a good way. In a way where I'm about to, like, you know, turn it to the Joker, right?
Yeah, chuck something at the TV.
Because it's like, you know, our man from Gladiator starts talking about his backstory, and within 2 seconds of, like, seeing this flashback, it's in slow motion, and you're like, of course it is, right? And then someone else talks. And I'll also say this, of all the people they collected in the first movie, I did at least remember all of them from, like, a visual standpoint. I'm like, okay, I remember the guy with the long hair, I remember the guy from Gladiator, I remember Not Katana. I swear, there's a woman with short hair who I could, for the life of me, not remember existing in the first movie.
Yeah, it's because she was the bait-and-switch one. Originally, they got Ray Fisher to show up, and then she just kind of tagged along. But then, I don't know if it's spoilers for the first movie or not, but then Ray Fisher didn't quite make it out, but she did.
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, the first one's kind of... I mean, to be you know what? Spoilers, guys, just spoilers for the... It's shit. It's terrible...
It is.
You don't want to watch it. You really don't. It's everything we said about the first movie still applies to this one, which leaves us just to go through and dissect the crap that's in this.
Well, here's the thing that I think makes it even worse for me, is that I think that the existence of the second one in the way that it is makes the first one worse, looking back on it. Because if you look at the first one, so much of that movie is Zack Snyder just zacking off on film of how much he can... build a universe, how much he's got all this lore and all this stuff that he wants to explore. We know all these different planets.
How little of it actually matters in this one.
We spend the entirety of this movie on one planet. We spend all of last movie showing, oh, look at this rich culture and all these cool things we can do. And then this movie comes around and we are stuck on the most boring 1800 Sweden planet I could possibly imagine.
Here's my thing. We won't talk about what any of it is yet, because, well, I guess I didn't say spoilers there, but we'll talk about it when we get through everything else.
Right.
But when I got to the last 2 minutes of this movie, and the last couple of scenes exist solely to set up another movie, I know he's been saying in the news or whatever, he's been saying, oh, he wants a part three, he wants to do a part three.
Oh, wow.
But this was a movie that was made so bloated, needlessly, might I add, because obviously I love Kill Bill. Kill Bill had the same thing. Kill Bill was too long, had to be split in two, but Kill Bill's fantastic, and I love all 4 hours of that goddamn thing. Right? This movie was bloated, and it had to be split in two. And what's so funny about it, effectively being this space ripoff of Seven Samurai, is that Seven Samurai is a long movie. It's 3 hours long, but it has so much more character development, so much more things to actually say than this does, despite being a full hour or so longer. It's baffling to me how little is actually in this movie. It's so thin. It is threadbare. And then what few things they did set out from a world-building point of view is basically meaningless for all of this movie, and then is just used in the last 2 minutes to say, hey, I guess that bit thing in your past still matters. Why don't we do something about it? Give us a part three, Netflix.
Oh, God.
I was so pissed off at the end of this.
Oh, yeah. I'm looking at the wiki article right now, and it says that the original plan was for a trilogy of movies, and then they expanded it out to 6 films, where each of the original trilogy will have its own 2 parts. And then Snyder came out and said, it's either going to be 4 films total or 6 films total, and that's basically going to come down to whether Netflix lets him pull off the part one, part two thing again.
This movie Like, there's entire things in this movie that just do not need to be in it. And if you also just cut there in the slow, like, that's the thing. I said there, you know, I complained about that section where they repeat montages of them doing the farming over and over again. And I'm like, you can cut all of that down to one well-paced montage that takes a minute. That's literally all you need to convey all that information. Instead, it's like 15 to 20 minutes of spreading it out needlessly. There's so much of this movie that falls into that. There's so much of that. And then on top of all that, of course, I don't care when emotional moments with certain characters are happening and like towards the end, because you've not made me care about any of these characters. Everything's been so shallow and devoid of interest.
But that was the part that I was actually a little bit excited for. That's a strong word.
Excited.
I was a little bit looking forward to, in regards to the first movie, is that they've so clearly set up what each of the characters' different roles are. You have the sword one. You have the one who's good with, like, animals and beasts and whatnot. You have the master strategist. You have just the gunner lady. You've got Korra just being the all-around big action hero. And all of them, by the time we get to this movie, are just, they know how to shoot things. Like, that's it. That's all they do. Sword lady's the only one that gets a little bit of specialization there.
Yeah. Honestly, I would extend that further. One of my big problems when we actually get to the siege on the village is that, like, this doesn't feel like Seven Samurai when it's all hinging on the Seven Samurai to be the ones leading the charge. Right. Honestly, most of these characters in the group they collected just feel like they're slightly better at fighting than the villagers, but they're just kind of in with the masses. I don't feel like they feel that important at all across the board.
They don't feel like the generals of the army. They feel like team captains. They feel like they're each leading their own little band, but they're still part of the team.
And just to cut out, like, most of the first movie, you could easily just have half of them just happen to live here and just have a pass where they know some skills. Like, the entire...
But then it wouldn't be Seven Samurai.
Well, yeah, then it would be Seven Samurai, but it doesn't need to be Seven Samurai.
Can I also, I want to throw out here that I said that I wanted to play ball with this movie. And so, not only did I watch part one, I watched the 30-minute featurette of making of the world of Rebel Moon. And I think what didn't surprise me, but what I was shocked at how forward they were about it, is that the entirety of the featurette in talking about the world building was just constantly going, like, do you remember in the first movie, there was that sequence with the bird creature and Tarek or whatever, and they were flying around the cliffside?
I remember him jumping on something like Avatar, yes.
Yeah. So they had a whole segment of that featurette that was talking about, like, oh, here's how we were thinking about this, and we were going to make this bird creature, like, come to life and all that stuff. And then they did the same thing for, like, the squid-looking dude who was holding the blood axes on his planet and whatnot. They did a whole thing for all of the aliens in the bar. And I noticed that every single time Zack Snyder spoke, he was saying, oh man, the lore for this universe is really deep. Like, there's all, we've mapped out all this stuff of, like, how the universe came to be and all this stuff like that. And only one time in the entire featurette did anybody say anything regarding the words theme or, like, story or anything like that. And I feel like that's just exactly what we got here, is that this is the consequence of the first movie being 100% focused on, look at how cool the universe is. And then you throw us back on this super basic ass planet where we're not able to see how cool the universe is anymore. And so we're left with just this bare bones, nothing happening, because there is no story here. There's no deeper narrative. There's no characters to care about. It's just runny, gunny, shooty, slow-mo.
The other thing I'd combat there is you implied that the first one was better because the universe was cool to see. I don't know, I think it was cool to see. It was still pretty generic and bland, but...
It's generic, but honest to God, I still think it was better. I think this would be, by virtue of setting this movie all on a singular planet that has absolutely nothing alien about it, it is just 1800 Swedish farmhouses. That's it. You have immediately robbed this movie of all of the things that it was trying to build up. There's nothing interesting about it anymore. To the point where, at the very, very end of this movie, there's a bunch of fighters that come in at the very end. One of them is an alien. Well, like, has the full prosthetics and all that. I forgot that we were in a universe that had aliens in it, because everyone else in this movie is human, wholesale.
Not counting the robot, obviously.
Well, yeah, but
yeah,
we have robots in our world too, so whatever.
Not voiced by Anthony Hopkins sounding bored.
I would love for my Roomba to sound like Anthony Hopkins every time it finished something.
There's a robot on Fallout voiced by Matt Berry, and I'm like, that's a inspired choice.
I would take that too. Honest to God, like, there's a lot of celebrity voices I'd be okay with.
Ah, dear. It's... And one way, because I got really tired in the first movie of just, like, going to planet to planet. It felt so repetitive that at least I didn't have that in this one, which is maybe why it seems slightly less annoying, but it was still full of things that was pissing me off. There was still, if anything, the one benefit to him just stretching out things over montages with nothing's happening, it's just an excuse for lots of slow-motion grain flying around, is that I had a license to just zone out and barely pay attention because nothing was happening. There's so much time in this movie where nothing is happening. So we're in spoilers, just to make that clear. Spoilers are ahoy for Rebel Moon Part 2. I wonder about the robot, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you see him watching a couple times early in the film. He's got his antlers on his head that we saw from the end of the first one, right? And there's an exchange that he has when they're prepping their plan, like halfway through the movie, and they've retrieved a little shuttle that our main character first arrived in when she crash landed here.
Yep.
Right? That's the thing, right? So they go get that. That's going to be part of their plan. And she's sort of mobilizing that. She's putting that somewhere in a hiding place. And the robot comes out and has a chat with her. And he's like, oh, I was built to protect the king's family. And because they're all dead, I have no purpose, blah, 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 blah. And she's like, hey, we're a lot alike. I was raised to, like, you know, kill for them too. And, like, I kind of lost my purpose. You know, there's kind of something similar here. And she basically says, hey, like, but we can make a choice to fight for something we believe in or something to that effect. And the robot just kind of shrugs and goes, I don't believe in anything. I don't. Or he says, it's hopeless. There's no point in fighting, right? Mm-hmm. And he wanders off. Now, I know, because I'm familiar with stories, that this is building up to him making a heroic kind of save sometime in the third act, right? Some big thing is going to be going down, and the robot's going to come in and probably be a badass because Zack Snyder makes everyone a badass because it's the only thing he likes.
Yep.
But correct me if I'm wrong. Normally, in a movie where you're going to have a character do the heroic save, there'll be some little moment or scene, or even a entire plot, but at least usually a little scene, that'll show the moment where they sort of, like, you can see they're thinking about it. There's something inspires the thought that they're going to come in and do the save.
And them walking over the hillside and looking over their shoulder.
Yeah, whatever it may be, right? Sometimes it may be something more, like, direct in terms of, like, oh, this actually motivates them to change their minds. Sometimes it's, no, they're just hesitating. Whatever. I don't think, until he shows up for his heroic save, that we even see him do anything after he has his conversation with Cora. That's her name, apparently. Our main character.
You're right. No, she's not in it. He shows up sporadically before that point where he's just on the hillside watching them prep for the fight. And then, once they're in the cave, he says, like, you're all going to die. Bye. And then nothing until he shows up. And I think in the course of his little heroic showing up, he does, like, three of the superhero landings. And then that's it. Like, that's all he does.
He throws some grenades at things and destroys the second crab tank. We'll get to some of that. But the effect that has is that when he showed up, I went, wait, he's having his big heroic moment, but nothing's inspired this. Nothing's told us that why he's changed his mind or why he's had second thoughts. There's not been a story told here about why he's came to this conclusion or even hinted at it. So I don't feel any sense of, oh, I knew he'd make the right choice, because they gave me no reason to think that he was even wrestling with the choice, really.
Right. Well, see, Pete, they originally had that in there, but then they looked at how cool the wheat was. It was being separated from the chaff in slow motion, and they're like, well, we gotta stretch that out.
Yeah, we gotta do that for 20 minutes.
Yep.
So, yeah, speaking of superhero landings, there's a moment in this movie where the villain jumps down a hole, and he lands in a superhero pose, but growls at the camera as he does, and I kind of lost my shit at that a little bit. I thought it was really, really silly bad.
Oh, yeah. The villain in this is just... He was not really that menacing beforehand, but they've moved him to just, like, cartoonishly stupid at this point. Like, there's nothing in this where it seems like he's actually a threat. It's always more so of just like, all right, who's going to be the one that actually gets the kill on him?
I think they did a whole thing where it was like he was killed, right, at mm-hmm. the end of part one. We knew he wasn't because they revealed before the end of the movie, no, he's actually been resuscitated by their fancy doctors or whatever. But I thought, like, okay, a normal storyteller, if they're going to do a thing where the villain appears to have been killed halfway through and he's not and he comes back, there will mm-hmm. be a good reason for that. Now, it might be because there's consequences. And for example, in this movie, our main characters even say at one point, no, that bad guy's definitely dead, so we don't have to worry about him. And I'm mm-hmm. thinking, oh, that's going to play into, like, things going wrong for them in the third act. And it doesn't make a goddamn bit of difference. He just shows up in front of them and they, like, have a shocked look in their face. And it's like, well, I guess we go on from here. Now, that's one potential thing. So they even tease that they could make it a mechanical thing where it plays into their expectations and then maybe they mm-hmm. lose a little bit before they finally succeed because they weren't expecting him to be around. That's one option. Option two is that you use this to, like, basically make the villain worse. Like, the idea is that he goes through this and he's angry that he was killed. He, like, wants vengeance now. It's not just about whatever else. And I can't for the life of me see a difference. He's just the same character he was before, and nothing special happens as a result of him dying. So the only, like, conclusion I can come to here is that Zack Snyder didn't know how to end part one without the villain losing the fight, but then the plot as a whole necessitates that he not be dead. So he just comes back with no consequence.
Honestly, I think that's it. Because if you really look at the structure of these two and you assume that it was supposed to be one movie overall beforehand, the last fight scene of the part one just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't fit in here. It doesn't make sense as to why they would have killed off this villain. Especially, there's a whole conversation when they're talking to the, like, village elders, whatever, where they're like, hey guys, guess what? We beat them on some other planet. Our planet is safe. And then little boy soldier who's been around this whole time says, actually, you're wrong. They're 5 days out. And it's like, why did we bother? Why did we bother with any of the last movie if you were immediately going to undo all of it within the first 10 minutes?
Now that we've seen part two, I'm convinced that the choice to split it into two happened before they shot it. Because you're right. The third act set piece in part one is solely just there so that the first part has an ending, has a big climactic action set piece spectacle thing, right? And then we just continue with the story as if it basically never happened. I mean, there's very little of consequence that comes out of it. One of the few things that kind of comes out of it is actually so bad on its own that, well, I'm going to rant about it now. So after everything else happens, right, I'm going right to the very end of the movie. The villain ship has come down. The villain is dead. We get our emotional, oh, lover boy's died, whatever his name is.
Gunner.
Right, Gunner, is that his name? Yeah. So this has all happened, right? And then out of nowhere, we see some, like, you know, fighter pilot things coming, you know, some jets coming in, some little spaceships, right? And it turns out to be the rebels, the clan that Ray Fisher's, like, him and his sister were running. So it's the sister characters, like the head, you know, she's in charge of the fleet, and then it's all these planes, and it's this big heroic moment, and our main character's looking up and goes, oh, look, they're here! The rebels are here! And here's my problem with this. Once they show up, my immediate thought was, yeah, but what do we need them for? Everything's over. And then as soon as I thought that, they started shooting at villain fighter planes. And I went, you know, to make this big heroic entrance mean something, maybe showing that there was a threat to the heroes, that they were in danger because there was, like, enemy fighters in the air, possibly still going to attack the village, I might have went, oh, that's a relief, some heroes have shown up. Instead, the heroes show up before I even know there's a threat, so I don't feel anything. I'm just like, oh, why are they here? Why is this a big deal? Oh, I guess there was bad guys to shoot down still. Okay.
No, every single one of our heroes at this point, like right before the fleet shows up, they're cheering. They're yelling. They're like, yeah, we did it. there's no implication that there is anybody left alive.
This is such just basic, like, this is a basic failure of storytelling. This is horrible. This moment is just exposing how bad Zack Snyder is at just basic storytelling, and maybe exposes that when he doesn't have a source material he can stick to religiously. Mm-hmm. Not that he does, but you know what I mean, like, at least in terms of structure and like visuals. I think it's exposing just how bad he is at it, because I think this moment is horrendous.
It is. And I mean, honestly, I think that as much as he talks about, like, oh, we have all this lore, we've really thought through, like, how this universe came to be and whatnot, I don't think they gave proper thought as to, like, how this universe is going to continue. Because let's just walk through this process for a second, okay? Just take the end of the movie as it is presented. They brought down the villain's big ship, the Dreadnought ship. They explicitly say that there are many of these ships in the Armada. There are many more that they can use. So explicitly, what is going to happen in this universe is 2 days later, three of those things are going to show up in the atmosphere and blow this village to kingdom come. Because they didn't take down the Empire. They didn't take down the Mother World. They took down one ship.
And I'm going to dispute this, and this is not because I want to defend the movie, but the impression I was getting, based on the whole... Because at the start of the movie, their logic to thinking why they'd already won for like a minute before they were told, no, they're still coming anyway, is that without an admiral, right, who's the villain, who's meant to be running the ship, they'd just return to base and it would be over, right? And they think that's it. The implication I'm getting here is that for whatever reason, there's not like long-range contact, and that basically the Empire wouldn't know where this dread ship went. That was the impression I was getting, and that's why they were thinking, oh, we're safe, at least for a good while.
And I would agree, but because I just watched part one, I know this little ditty. And that is during that little almost post-credit scene, Admiral nearly died. He had that telepathic communication thing with the general.
Oh, I forgot about that.
And he explicitly said, she is on this planet, and we are going to go get her. So... Yep, nope, that is 100% that plan is getting blown to smithereens. Also, one thing that I...
Hold on, I bet you it doesn't, at least not anything.
Oh, no,
quickly.
Not at all.
I bet it doesn't.
Because it wouldn't, because they won the fight, and that's enough that Zack Snyder's like, and we're done with that. We never have to worry about it, because by the end of this movie, they're going off planet. They don't have to worry about it.
By far, the most interesting of the entire group is the only one that dies. Right? Out of the warriors, I'm not counting the love interest Gunner, because he was just one of the villagers, right? I'm out of the warriors they collect. The only one that actually dies is Katana, right? It's Nemesis, apparently, is her name.
Nemesis.
She has this big death, and I thought some of the others were going to die, but this is before I knew we were just going to set up another movie at the end, and we literally have all of them still together saying, yeah, we're with you, Korra. We're going to go deal with this backstory of yours. And it's like, why is the only one that was slightly cooler than the rest of them is the only one that didn't make it to the end. So now we're stuck with these bland-ass characters for a potential third one.
Can I just say that was my favorite dialogue scene? Because they all four of them come around in a circle and say, like, we're with you, Korra, we're going to do it. And the first one says, I'll be with you. The second one says, me too. The third one says, we're all with you. But then there's still the fourth guy, the guy from Gladiator. And so he just has to tack on, me too. And I'm like, bro, the guy who said we're all with you covered that. The me too just makes it sound like you just not listening to the conversation here.
And then she's like, the robot steps in and says, because this is the other thing. He reveals here, Gladiator dude, because I can't pronounce his name, so I'm just going to say Gladiator dude.
It's Titus in the
movie. Okay, yeah. He says, oh, by the way, like, you didn't kill the princess. She's still alive. So they have flashback. Yeah. We have to talk about the flashback. So
one thing that I just wanted to make clear from the last movie is that when they're all captured and Noble, the bad guy, is walking his way down the line, he lists off everybody's crimes. He said, like, you did this, did this. And he gets to Korra and he says, Korra, I know your real name is whatever it is, Aurelethile or whatever.
Ariola.
I don't think that's it, but sure. So your real name's Areola. And he lists off like the things she did. And then at the end of the movie, Titus says, "Hey, wait a minute. Are you actually Areola?" And she's like, "No." And somehow she's like, she thinks that convinced him. She thinks that she's like, "Oh, good thing they don't actually suspect me of murdering the royal family."
But they're all sharing their backstories, and it gets to her. She leaves out all that part. And he's like, "Is there anything else you want to add there, Cora?" And she's like, "Nah, that's everything." And she finally confesses at the end of the movie, and that's what prompts this conversation where they're like, "Hey, let's go find the princess and like take down this villain who overtook the empire." And it's like, well, first of all, like in the flashback early on, because we get because she does tell lover boy near the start, because they kiss and have sex, and it's when they're, you know, canoodling afterwards where she starts opening up and telling him who she really is. And first of all, when they had like their moment where he's like, "Oh, the worst fear I had during that act three finale of the last movie was that I'd lose you," and I went, was there an implied love flick thing in the last movie? I don't remember there being a romantic element to this, was it?
For him to her, yes. Okay. He was constantly making googly eyes. She never had a goddamn interest in him at all.
Yeah. Well, you know, Areola, she's also Cora. Just call her Cora.
Yeah, that's probably better. She has a government name, but she goes by Cora.
Goes by Cora. Yes. The chick from Climax. And hey, she climaxed in the movie, so...
we don't know that. He could have been an awful lover.
Yeah, she seemed relaxed afterward, I think. I think he... Like, I'm not saying it was a home run, but I think he rounded the bases.
All right. He knows how to handle his wheat.
Well, you have to, or things might chafe.
I can feel the subscribers leaving. Anyway.
Yeah, so right. She starts talking about like what happened, and like I'll admit I zoned out for the first part of her narration, so I was like, "Oh, am I going to understand this?" And I kinda did by the end. I will say the villain, like the true villain, the Emperor, who's this like Beryllius guy, who's the one who orchestrated the assassination of the royal family, like I had forgotten who he was from the first movie, so it took a lot of them mentioning him throughout the movie to remind me, you know, just by context, like, okay, this is, yeah, okay, whatever, I get it now. But we get this whole thing where she's been coerced into leading the royal family into this trap where the royal family, you know, the mother and father, mother's killed, dad is killed too, but he's still kind of alive to watch his daughter die. He's still kind of lying there bleeding out. And she's the one tasked, Cora's the one tasked with killing the daughter. And the daughter turns and looks at her and is like, "I forgive you." And she's like, "Don't," and pulls the trigger. But for some reason, the princess, when she's shot, bursts like light comes out of her. Now, was there anything in the first movie that set up that she's some sort of special fairy or something? Because I don't...
Yeah, her whole thing was that there was a prophecy that because she's named after an ancient queen named Life Giver, that she also has the ability to give life. And Cora saw her bring a dead bird back to life once. So, yeah, she's a special girl.
Yeah, I forgot. Honestly, there's a lot of these things. Same with the rebels coming in the planes at the end. There's a lot of things here that really tell me that this was, at least initially, meant to be one movie. Because they make no effort to set any of these things up again before you see them. So when this girl's had light coming out of her wound, I was like, what the hell is happening? When the planes come out at the end, I'm like, who the hell are these? Oh, yeah, the sister character. Like,
right. Oh, yeah, no, it was absolutely supposed to be watched together. I can't imagine this movie is, like, even with a four-month gap, and that is, I think, as small of a gap as you can reasonably expect, it's still not going to stick in your mind all of the things that you need to remember here. One thing, though, with that scene, with that flashback scene, I have to bring up is that the king, queen, and princess are brought into this room where the general's obviously going to kill them. And they have a string quartet playing that is providing in-scene music that as everyone is getting stabbed to death, the string quartet is like picking up its like antics as well. I thought that was the goofiest goddamn thing I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's fair. Yeah, we do see Ray Fisher briefly as well. Talk about his sister in the movie, but he shows up in one of the flashbacks. One of the, I think it's a Gladiator guy's story.
The girls.
It's the girls. You're right. Because she, well, let's go through these flashback stories actually, because there's a little lump of them. So, yeah, hers is that she had longer hair. I remember that. She was a part of some sort of small village as well, I think.
Yeah, she was basically on some planet, and then the Empire came in and said, all right, we're going to kill everybody who can't work, and everybody else is going to work camps.
Went to work camps, and then the rebels, led by Ray Fisher's character, seemed to liberate them, and so we get him walking in slow motion looking at her as planes fly overhead or something. Yeah. There was the whole thing.
It's just a military recruitment, commercial. That's all it is.
It is, yeah. Gladiator guy's backstory, of course, is that he did work for the Empire before, and he was basically shunned by them because when the village they went after basically turned the tables and, captured all of his platoon, he effectively offered himself up to save his men because he thought that was the noble thing to do. But the Empire doesn't like that. They see that as a betrayal or something.
You're misreading that scene just a little bit.
No? Okay, go on.
So what happened was there was a village, like a town or planet or something, that was voting to basically do a Brexit from the Empire. And so,
topical reference, David, go on.
I mean, that's the best way to say it. They were just kind of divorcing themselves from it. And so his ship, Titus's ship, was just over top of the Capitol building and was told to open fire when they voted for freedom.
Mm.
And he refused, and as such, because he refused, the Empire was like, well, this is your punishment. We're gonna kill you, or we're gonna kill all of you. And then he offered up saying, hold on, just kill me, let my men go free. I was the one who didn't give the order. And then the Empire, being the dicks they are, killed his entire group and forced him to watch.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah,
I'm not gonna claim I was paying full attention watching.
No,
that.
That's fine. That's all right. That's the thing is, every single one of these backstories is basically the Empire is the worst they could possibly be. There is no sort of thing where anybody likes the Empire in any meaningful way. They are always pure evil, and they benefit nobody.
Yeah, the long-haired guy, he was like a prince, and his father tried to go and give terms to the Empire, but they sent him back in a coffin and said, we're coming to invade. And then his mother had to commit suicide as the invasion was happening, and he had to go into hiding, and that's how he ended up wherever he was.
Honest to God, that really doesn't explain anything about his backstory, though.
No.
It's like, and I had to go into hiding. And then all of a sudden we meet up with him and he's in slavery, working off a debt of I think it was $300,000 or something like that. It's like, how the hell did you get from A to B, bro?
And then Nemesis, Katana Lady, her village was decimated by the Empire. And while they were a peaceful village, her ancestors were warriors. And this was what really made me think of Katana, because obviously she's an Asian woman with swords, right?
Yeah.
But she's basically says, oh, there was these ancient robotic gauntlets, right? And she cuts off her arms. She cuts her arms off herself, and then the robot arms attached to her like gloves. Mm-hmm. And she says the line, something to the effect of, the spirits of my ancestors' warriors were in the gloves, and they reignited that fire within me. And I went, oh, so it's the souls in Katana's sword then, who are helping her and edging her on. All right.
I really needed Rick Flagg to be there and say, this is Nemesis. I suggest you don't get killed by her.
What are we, some kind of Suicide Squad? Honestly, she is definitely the most interesting of the bunch. That's not to say that all of her stuff was good, though, because it did feel super edgy for her to just immediately start cutting off her arms to put these robot arms on.
Dude, her entire plot is just so, I get what they were going for, but I think it does the character such a disservice. Because throughout the entire wheat-flipping scene that we were talking about before, there's this one little blonde boy who, keeps playing with her. Yeah. Teasing her.
I was about to jump
that.
In and fight you there because you said the word entire, but I think you were just phrasing it. Because I want to make this clear. This connection with the little blonde boy is one moment that's in that wheat section. It's one moment where she's kind of like chilling and she's resting and she's got the hat down and like she's asleep under the sun. Mm-hmm. And the little boy comes up and like tries to tickle her, I guess, with a wheat.
Yeah, just like poke a little wheat thing in her face, see if she's going to react.
Right. And she kind of like, you know, puts her head up and he runs off and sort of laughs. And she doesn't really show anything, but then you can see her smirking when she puts her head back down, like, ah, the little shit, what a little devil. And then later on, when she's fighting the bad guys, he like jumps in to like stab one of them because she's losing. And then she has to jump in and save him, and that gets her killed.
Right. But like the entirety of her plot and the way that they are describing it, especially because there's a scene earlier, and I really want to talk about that, is that they ascribe to her a motherhood plot. They ascribe to her this idea that, like, oh, she doesn't have her own kids, but she feels this urge to be a mother and, like, protect them like that. And I think that is so weakening of the character. Like, you have the ability to make this character this strong, silent type, but like, oh, no, but really what they want to do is love. That's the whole thing deep down. And I don't know. Especially, maybe it's because it is a woman rather than a male character, but it just feels like it's boiling it down to this almost offensive level of like, well, clearly all these people just want to be mothers, right? That's what has to happen.
Yeah. Did you like the fact that despite the fact that they had to do like a month's worth of like farming, like to harvest all the grain, and they did all that in 3 days? At the end of day three, when they were done working literally like 18 hours a day to get it done with everyone pitching in, they get to the end of that day and somehow some of the townsfolk have had time to make them all these quilt things with symbols on them.
All right. This is the scene I wanted to talk about.
Okay.
This is the scene. So structurally in this movie, nothing has happened.
Nope.
Like actually nothing has happened. We have the wheat scenes.
We're like 45 minutes in at this point. I want to be that clear as well, right?
Yeah. No. And we have this big dinner thing and they're like, hey, everybody, we did it. Huzzah. And then the little blonde girl who we focused on in the first movie, she comes out and she's like, oh, we made these offerings to you. And we have these symbols that describe you. And she starts listing off characteristics about these characters that we don't know as an audience. She's like, Titus, when I first saw you, you were unmovable like a mountain. So your symbol is the mountain. And I'm like, who the hell is Titus? I don't know anything about this character. You have shown me nothing across both movies to tell me why Titus is an unmovable mountain.
The only thing I can say for him, and it's only because, they did one thing to point out in this movie, but they reminded me that he was kind of an alcoholic in the last movie. And in this one, he's pretending to be drinking booze, but he's actually just drinking water because he's hiding how much he's like taking this seriously for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I guess that's something.
Wow, you developed the character a tiny little bit.
It's not a lot, but it's something.
Honestly, Titus, I'm willing to give a little bit of a pass to because he actually like talks to people and like acts as a leader. You know who I'm not going to give a pass to? Tarek. Little bird boy with the long hair. Because tell me anything about Tarek. Tell me like one thing about Tarek.
Honestly, I think him, I think the short-haired lady, whose name I...
Milius.
God, she's really far down the cast list. Yep. I was just scanning to see the name. She's really far down. Tarek, Milius, mainly those two. Because obviously Nemesis is dead, so whatever.
Right.
But like those two characters get no story. They have moments. Mm-hmm. So they're given moments where they're firing blasters at things or throwing grenades or dodging debris, but they have no story. They have no story in this or progression. And I mean,
if we look at it by the who's around at the end of the movie, I'm also going to throw Jimmy, the robot, in there. Because, again, it seems like he should have a whole thing. And all they give him is that he was a robot for the Dead King and now he is able to fight again.
This reminds me. So, in the first movie, there was the one soldier, the platoon, that turned out to be like sympathetic because he kind of liked the blonde girl. But he ended up helping them and he's on their side now, right? He wasn't happy with them trying to gang rape her because, hey, one person in this whole platoon has to be a decent human being, so I guess it's him.
You'd think so.
Fine, right? At the start of this movie, he gets a call on like their little hologram device from the main ship, right? And he pretends that he's still working for them to just sort of get an update. And they're like, hey, we're going to be there in 5 days, right? And that sets up the warning. That's how they know how long they've got left. They call him again a little bit later once the villain's up and about. And he's like, yeah, everything's going fine. The wheat will be all done. The grain's going to be bagged and ready to go by the time you arrive, sir. And the general, whoever it is like, you know, where's the other two, like, you know, command leaders that are down there with you? He's like, oh, they've been cracking the whip. They're all out there making sure they're working hard. That's what they're doing. He's like, all right. And then the main villain just sort of saunters over after the call ends and goes, yeah, he's turned sides. Those other guys are definitely dead. And I was like, okay, fair enough. Like, they're showing that the villains figured that out.
Yeah.
This matters not. Mm-hmm. This does not affect anything that they have figured this out in advance.
Nope. I think the only thing you could argue that it affects is that if they thought that the other people were still in charge, they would just send down like a tiny little troop, like a one or two ships.
It affects that, I guess. Yeah. But what I'm trying to say is that this character, the young soldier who's sided with the villagers, like, I thought this was setting up like some sort of consequence for him, where he, maybe either he'd be killed or maybe they'd try to kill him and he'd have to like fight his way out and the villagers would have to stick up for him. You know, something that would be, what's the word I'm looking for? A story. Something that would have a payoff to the fact that you set this up.
You see, I think they did him a real disservice by making Titus a general in the Empire's army. Because I would imagine you have a guy who's a brilliant tactician or whatever, but doesn't know about the Empire's methods. And then this guy's able to step up and say, like, oh, no, we do things this way. And he's able to provide, like, information and help out the group that way. Because obviously, he's not, like, a muscle head. He's a pretty scrawny kid, all things considered. So I don't see there's any way that you could make his character really work in the story that's provided. And yeah, they didn't. They when it comes down to it, he just kind of sat off to the side and watched Nemesis get killed.
Yeah, I mean, and also, there's also, once the fighting starts, there's a lot of like characters who just stand and wait to get shot that was really sticking out to me. There's one guy who tries to reload his like single shot shotgun kind of laser weapon, and of course, he doesn't take cover to reload. He just stands there reloading, and would you believe it? He gets shot and killed within like 2 seconds.
What? No.
Just a bunch of dumb shit. So, yeah, once the action actually kicks off, and like the main bad guy comes down with a platoon, he basically makes an offer to Cora that if she turns herself in, they'll leave the village standing. Now, I think the audience would be quite justified in thinking, he's a lying piece of shit. He's just going to kill them anyway. Yeah. Right? But Cora's like convinced and she's like, I'm going, my love. Like, I'm just going to turn myself in for my penance to save the village. No one has to die because of me. And then lover boy grabs her gun and shoots the big drum that they were meant to bang to, like, and, you know, to tell everyone, okay, this is an attack. Yeah. And they've dug some holes and tunnels in the ground. So these, like, someone pops their head out with a grenade launcher or a rocket launcher and hits the ship that's in the background, and this is their first attack. We see the main bad guy go on a warpath, like snapping necks and stuff in the tunnels because he's pissed off,
which I get that is to make the main bad guy look intimidating and like a real threat up until this point, but like honest to God, the way that they performed it, of him just like going down this tunnel, it is a narrow ass, like maybe 3 feet across tunnel, and all of these people with ranged weapons and lasers and stuff cannot shoot him down a straight line tunnel, and it doesn't make him seem badass, it makes all the farmers seem absolutely incompetent.
That's exactly what I was saying about the waiting to be shot. It's just, there's a lot of action in this. Whenever they have like one of, they're trying to do that badass thing where a character's like surviving down a hallway of bad guys, because it happens on the big ship once Cora's on it later. She's got a hallway scene up there. It doesn't look that impressive because it feels like they're just waiting for her to do her moves rather than feeling like she's like dodging and blocking and actually really having to defend herself.
It strikes me that like Zack Snyder was more worried about the visuals of like specifically what Cora was doing. And so when the choreographer came in and said, hey, you know, these guys are just standing off here waiting, he's like, yeah, but I don't care about them. They're not the focus of the scene.
I think it's possible the choreography is not even bad. It's just that because everything's in such slow motion, it just points out how slow everyone's being at actually attacking her. If it was in regular speed, maybe it would actually look all right, but...
I'll tell you right now, watching at 1.5 speed where it actually undid some of the slow motion, it doesn't. It doesn't make it look better.
You didn't watch this one on 1.5 speed, did you?
I did not. No, oh, I had to watch. I know the rules.
Yeah. No cheating. No cheating. Yeah, so they do a whole big thing here where they've got like a crab tank, the bad guys, and that's coming in. They're really struggling to deal with it. And they do a whole big thing where like one guy is able to like get a grenade in, or it's the short-haired girl who like jumps out and like fires a rocket launcher at like point-blank range to destroy it. And they're all happy. They think they've beat the wave of enemies. And then once the smoke starts to clear, a second crab tank's coming with another big platoon, and they're like, shit. And then it's that leads to the robot jumping in, and he takes out the second crab thing. In fact, he literally jumps out the crab. He looks like Superman taking off, because he like just sort of jumps straight up vertically out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But
again, he's so underutilized here because he's used for this one scene. He shows up, everyone starts firing at him. Obviously, being a robot, he's able to tank the shots. He kills everyone who's immediately firing at him. He takes out the big crab tank, and then he's done. Like, he doesn't do anything
else. That's it. Yeah. Well,
it feels so underutilized.
This was something that was bothering me about this as well, is you collected all these people, these warriors, to be the Seven Samurai, and then it felt like everything on the village was just a distraction, because the actual real fight, the real mission, was Korra sneaking onto the big ship to try and take out the big ship.
Yeah.
So, and everything in the village felt like it was subplot, and that felt really weird, given the whole thing's been building up to, this is about us making a stand and defending the village.
I mean, I kind of get it from the viewpoint of it's essentially the ticking clock of, we have to complete this part of the mission before the village is completely and utterly annihilated. Like, that's their end goal there. Because otherwise, there's no tension to it. They could blow up the ship whenever they wanted to.
Yeah, I'm not saying that I even have a problem with that part of the plot of them going up and trying to take out the ship, but... Mm-hmm. At a certain point, that's all we focused on, and all we ever did was cut back for a couple of quick, like, oh, we're ducking shots and we're barely surviving, and that was it. It felt like all these characters we've collected should feel like they're doing important things in the main fight down on the ground, and yeah, the winning coup de grace is going to be destroying their big sort of dreadnought ship, like, from within, and that's ultimately what's happening. And, you know, of course, that ends up being ridiculous when it goes where it all tips sideways, and we get them sliding down in slow motion, and the villain. Here's the thing: Villain Man's motivation here is that he'll be rewarded with a promotion for bringing her back because she's wanted for killing, you know, the previous emperor and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't seem that pissed off that he was like effectively killed by her.
Nah, I mean, it seems like one of those things where it should be okay. Now there is a personal link between the villain and the hero that. Like, They can now connect to each other in a deeper way. But it's like, nah, it was just an inconvenience. It's like a Tuesday traffic jam or something.
It's like what I was saying, but no consequence to that ending to the first movie. If nothing else, if he at least now hated her because she beat him, that would be something. It'd be like, okay, now he's got this fire lit under him or something. But it just feels like, oh no, I'm going to get like a good pat in the head for bringing you in, and that's all it is.
Yep. So I want to divert really quickly to two different things.
Uh-huh.
The first one is, last review, we couldn't quite figure out what it meant to be Child of Fire. You know, the subtitle. We thought it applied to Korra, but we didn't quite understand what that meant. I'm going to double down here in that we know specifically Korra is the Scar Giver.
Yes.
But at no point in her entire backstory, in all of her flashbacks of her showing her killing the royal family or whatnot, why is she the Scar Giver?
Hold on. I assume she got that name for assassinating the princess. Did she already have that nickname?
I don't know. I have no idea. But like, it doesn't make sense to me that like, oh, you know, killing the princess is somehow giving a scar. I don't.
Yeah, I mean, that's weird, I admit. But
yeah. See, she, at one point during her flashback, she aims the gun at Belisarius. And I thought, like, oh, she's going to shoot him, but he'll survive, but he'll have, like, a scar or something. And that's how she becomes Scar Giver. But no, That does it. She just leaves. And I have no idea what Scargiver means either. I feel like both the subtitles here were just thought up of and didn't have any relevance to the plot itself.
I mean, Scargiver makes a little bit more sense to me, not in like how she gets the name, but at least I understand at least that in the context of this is her name. This is what she's known as a sort of infamous kind of outlaw. So I at least understand the title better compared to the first one, just based on that. Now, admittedly, yes, where she got that title, were they calling her that forever? Was it just because of what she did? I don't know. That's up in the air.
Yeah, that's fine. I just wanted to bring that up. Second thing, and I wanted to bring this up earlier, but I forgot about it. The scene where they resurrect the bad guy. He's God bless Zack Snyder here, because he manages to fit this into every single one of his movies, even if it doesn't make any sense. When the bad guy is resurrected, he's like super complaining that he's being held back in the med bay. And the commander comes down to visit him, and he's got like this fabric over his shoulder, and he's like, you know, he's walking around pacing all angry and whatnot.
It's a toga. He's got a goddamn toga on.
Yeah, pretty much. And
which reminds me, actually, in the flashback where the assassination happened, there was like guards standing around that were all wearing these ridiculous big togas that had like a big ribbon on it. It really stuck out.
It was 100% supposed to be the killing of Caesar. Like, that's all they were trying to represent there, because they all use knives as well. Anyway, he's wearing a toga. The medical director says, you can't leave. We got to run tests. He kills the medical director. And then the commander asks him, well, what's the plan? What are we going to do? And the camera slowly tilts upwards, aiming upwards at the bad guy. And we see this halo of light around his head as he stands there with a toga, and he says, I'm going to get the Scargiver and I will be a savior to the Empire. He did a goddamn Jesus Christ metaphor again. He can't stop doing it. We have a character returning from the dead, a halo of light, wearing a toga, saying he's a savior. Why is Zack Snyder so intent on doing the Christ metaphor?
Because he thinks that if you compare something to Christ, it's instantly deep.
He's wrong. Because I did roll my eyes. Yeah.
Of course he's right. I don't know. So I complained a lot in the last movie. I talked a lot about how Zack Snyder only knows how to give people endings if they die and sacrifice themselves. Mm-hmm. There's not a ton of that in. I mean, there is some of it, obviously. You get Nemesis and Gunner, right? Both sacrifice themselves to an extent.
There's also a few villagers who, I swear to God, don't even have names. As they were dying on the field, they made sure to give them a zoom in and see the sadness in their eyes as they sacrifice themselves for the cause.
That said, though, there was a lot of talk of that kind of attitude, though. Like, when they're all making their promises, like, oh, yeah, I'm willing to die for this. There's a moment where Short-Haired Girl and Tarek, like, they're basically saying, hey, I don't want to die anymore, but if we go together, and then the charge. And there's a lot of that kind of bravado still in there. So it may not be quite as thick as the Ray Fisher ending last movie, where it really was kind of the typical Zack Snyder sacrifice scene, but there was definitely still some shimmers of it in this.
Yeah, it felt like they heard you. It felt like they heard you say, oh, everyone's so nihilistic and they all just want to die all the time and it doesn't make it, you know, for a good character. And so they have to explicitly say, I don't want to die, but I'm willing to.
Well, here's the thing. The only reason why, like, almost all of them don't die is because he already knows he wants more movies, so he has to leave them alive. I guarantee you, by the end of the fourth or sixth, whatever the last movie is going to be, I guarantee you that most of these characters are dead.
No, absolutely. No
most
doubt.
Most of them are dead. It's just, without a doubt, I don't even hesitate to say it.
I'd say the end of the next movie, whether that's one part or two parts, I think we're going to have at least two more deaths.
Yeah, that's fair.
Wholesale.
That's fair. So, is there anything else to talk about? I don't know if there's anything else about.
Okay, so I want to talk about Korra's plot in taking down the Dreadnought. So, Peter, if your entire core plot, like, yeah, they got to defend the village or whatnot.
Your core plot.
The core plot of this is to take down the Dreadnought. And you have to hop in a ship to do that. Would you keep the ship as far away as humanly possible? Or would you keep it kind of close by so that you can, you know, leave?
Well, close, I guess. Why?
Yeah, you'd think so, but clearly they didn't. She flew it like halfway. She hit it inside of a cliffside waterfall. And I'm like, there is no possible worse place to put that for needing to make a quick escape here. They drove it out to the middle of nowhere. And to be fair, the movie treats it like it's nothing. The movie treats it like it is just like a hop, skip, and a jump away. But clearly it's not. And I can't believe that they just said, yeah, no, that thing that's super important to the plan, we're going to put 3 miles down the road. Good luck.
Yeah, well, because part of the plan is that the first thing they did when they attacked the Empire when they arrived is like blow up at least one of their shuttle ships, because the whole plan revolves around them sneaking onto the ship by pretending to be one of the shuttles coming back with the others when they retreat. And they get on board, she, you know, works her way through the ship, killing some people, getting to the engine room and planting some explosives. It's kind of wild that they don't notice until they're about to blow up that there's explosives attached to the engine core, because it takes them some time.
That was driving me crazy.
Because Cora's like going around having hallway fight scenes and everything in this time. She's standing and having like a face off with the main bad guy, which then turns into a fight. And this is the point where, you know, when she's fighting one of the guards that have one of those like vibro blades, which is, you know, like a machete that also lights up like it's a lightsaber.
It's a lightsaber.
Yeah. I call it a vibroblade because there's a weapon in XCOM 2 that's kind of like this, where it's like it's like a blade that's got like a serrated edge that lights up. She gets this and she can't touch the handle because they use gloves to handle this thing. So she just like grabs some like a shirt or something and she sort of wraps it around the handle so she can hold it. So if the comparisons to Star Wars, which we talked a lot about in the first part, I mean this time it's maybe less relevant. But the fact that the final fight between her and the bad guy is nothing but these laser swords, right?
Yeah.
Really, really stood out to me as this clearly, especially when, like, you know, she dodges out the way of one of his swings and it cuts through some of the metal behind her. I'm like, this is just what a lightsaber does. Like, this is just the lightsaber fight. And admittedly, on like a purely base level, I actually think the idea of an actual blade that's got a laser edge is actually cooler to me than a traditional lightsaber, but it doesn't change the fact that this is just, you know.
Yeah, you've like, hit the same end point, but you just went through a different route.
Yeah, like I think if this was in a better movie, I'd probably like the idea of fighting with these things, because it feels more vicious somehow. Like, because when it's just a pure laser, it's like, oh, this, it almost seems like humane to like decapitate someone with that. But with this thing, it feels kind of like, oh no, you're still going through with a blade. Like, there's still like a bit of just raw.
It doesn't feel like just pure energy. It feels like metal that's been superheated.
Yeah.
Or electrified.
So, I don't know. But either way, I was sitting going, oh, this is just such a lightsaber fight at the end of this. Which, you know, the fact that she's been using guns the entire two parts, like, that was such a big thing when she finally got her gun back on in the first movie. And, you know, she's even dual wielding at one point in this. The fact that that's all ditched to have a fight with one of these blades just kind of felt like this is very Star Wars, and the fact that it all built up to a lightsaber fight.
I agree, but I think that's kind of what annoyed me in this movie as well, though, especially when it came down to the Nemesis fight and the farmhouse. Is I don't feel like they did enough in this movie to justify why nobody is using ranged weapons. Like, for the final fight scene with Kor and whatnot, they show her slashing his gun, and then he just has a sword on standby. All right, I'll take it. I feel like he'd be able to get another gun pretty easily, but I'll take it. But for the Nemesis fight, I swear to God, she slashes, like, one gun in half, and then everybody just pulls out their swords to fight this lady who is clearly specialized in swords. Like, am I crazy there? I feel like everyone else had a gun still.
Yeah, and this just goes back to them waiting to take their turn. And I know like lots of action movies have had that problem in the past where you can sometimes feel that they're waiting. But I really felt it here. And again, it's probably the slow motion making it feel 10 times worse.
Yeah.
But I think that just goes into, again, just like, we're doing this because Zack Snyder's decided he wants a specific moment and he's not really caring about the logic of how we get to that moment. He's just doing it.
Also, do you remember in the first movie, the whole reason that they had to partner up with that Irish guy who betrayed them was because they needed a ride off the planet?
Yeah, vaguely, yeah.
They have a ship. They showed that it took like an hour to fix up Korra's ship, and they just had to clear out some bird's nests, and it was good to go.
Yeah,
why could they not use that ship?
Because I don't think it's like long range. I think it's just a shuttle that goes back up to the main ship.
Is it a shuttle? All right, fair enough. If you have an explanation, that's fine. But it seems to me like that was a super easy like.
I also think it may have been a secret that like she landed in a little shuttle like that because it was just like, the guy that took her in that knew about it. So it was kind of on the hush hush.
Yeah, but clearly this is a desperate times call for desperate measures sort of thing if they needed to get off the planet.
Well, yeah, but they would need to tell everyone because it took the entire village with ropes to pull it out of the swamp or whatever it was in.
Yeah, and I think that if your entire village is about to be decimated, you say, yeah, okay, and she showed up here in the ship. We got to pull the ship out now.
I don't have a particular problem with that part, but
that's fair.
I mean, I didn't enjoy anything as it was happening, but I just don't have a particular plot hole problem with that.
I think it was only because I was watching part one to part two, like, right afterwards. So all those little things that didn't quite line up, despite the fact they were filmed at the same time, I was like, movie.
I think my first answer is the more lately one. It's not a long range. I don't think you can go planet to planet in one of those because it's not got like a warp core or a light speed drive, whatever they're using in this universe to get around.
I remember, this is part one. I'm surprised they didn't come back to it again. It's they tear open the space and it folds open and it looks like genitals.
Yeah. I can believe that the little shuttles can't do that. But that's like that's a big ship. That's a big boy ship thing.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right, I'll give it that.
Yeah, okay. Ultimately, it's Lover Boy that stabs him in the back that kind of, you know, ends the fight effectively, right after they've already slid down. He's been shot by this point, so he's kind of weak, but...
Oh, yeah, as soon as the ship starts, like, falling down and they start sliding down all of it, it's wholesale, you lose all geography and, like, sense of where you are, but doubly so where the hell Gunner is, because he just at one point slides down past them and he just disappears. Like, nobody has any idea where he's at until he shows up with his own sword and stabs the guy through the chest. And I especially love the fact that Korra doubles down of, like, the last time I did this, he survived. So I'm going to make sure he's dead this time. And she traps him in a automatic door and then cuts off his head. So I think he's dead. I don't think he's going to come back for somehow Palpatine has returned.
No. I felt like the beheading itself felt kind of anticlimactic to me. Like, it didn't feel like... Again, and I think this just ties into... It's less about the action that she's doing and taking, because it's obviously a big moment from, like, a physical point of view. But because we don't really feel that there's, like, a real hatred between them, or like a personal vendetta... It doesn't feel like a big moment emotionally for the movie. It just feels like, oh, that's just him gone now.
Well, they tried to make it that, because remember, he's strangling her, and he's saying, like, look at me as I kill you. And I get from him that he has some level of animosity, but for her, I feel like it's just another bad guy, you know? There's no personal relationship there.
Yeah, they just didn't make it feel like it mattered to each other. I don't know. What else is there? Is there anything else to talk about?
I think we, like, briefly mentioned it, but just to make super clear is that in the ending, as she's revealing her whole backstory to the group, as if they didn't already know it, Titus says, oh, by the way, the princess that was super clearly dead in your flashback, she survived, and she's out there somewhere.
Yeah.
And so the end goal for the next two movies is... get the princess back to the royal throne and take out Belisarius as the regent who's in control.
I don't think... I mean, let's just assume that there's going to be, like, two parters, right? I don't think they'll be taking back the throne at the end of the second, like, overall movie. I think they might find her by the end of that movie, but I don't think they'll completely get back in power.
I don't know.
Well, what's the last two movies if they're already...
Oh, you're saying, sorry, I was misunderstanding what you were saying by, like, two parts of stuff. Yes, I think by the time that all six movies are done, then she's back in control.
Oh, sure, like, yeah, that's fine. I'm saying that I don't think that she'll be back. I think they'll find her by the end of 4, and then, that's the overall ending will eventually be that they take back the Empire.
Yeah, honest to God, I think that this may be the worst way to phrase movie releases, is that it's 3 movies, each in 2 parts, because it's just confusing.
It's awkward, it's annoying.
Yeah. Plus, I guarantee you the next one's going to be called Rebel Moon Part 3. Like, there's way they're going to name it anything else.
It's the funny thing is, though, is that watching it, you can clearly tell that that's what it is, though, that it is just 3 movies split into 2 each, because that's how it feels when you're watching it. But at the same time, just call it the next 4 movies, I guess.
People have, like, Netflix, you understand, you basically built the binge model. People can sit there for an extended period of time and just watch a thing. You don't have to break it up into these smaller bite-sized chunks. You can just do it. Just put it all there.
Yeah, I don't really want to watch 2 parts of this, though, at the same time.
Yeah.
So
I don't know. Here's the thing I realized about halfway through this movie, is that as much as I think it is worse, it's worse in a way that makes me care less. Like, the other one, I was just more pissed off at, like, the choices they made and how disappointing it was and all these different things and how they didn't set up all this stuff. But this one, it's just an extended fight scene. And like I said, there's no space opera to it. There's no, let's see what this universe actually has in store to it.
It's one-third farming, two-thirds extended fight scene.
True. I will give you that. Which, if I'm going to be honest here, I will say the fighting is better than the farming. So,
not by
maybe
much.
That's what they were doing.
Not by much, though.
God, honest to God, in that little featurette I watched that was like 30 minutes long of how they did it, they were so goddamn proud of themselves. Because they did the Nolan thing where they made an actual field of wheat and they waited for it to grow. And then they harvested it all and used, like, that was all real stuff they did. And they were so proud of that. They were like, yeah, no, we're doing this for real. This isn't something we brought in, like, special effects. That's real wheat. And I'm like, guys, you need to take a step back from the project if this is the thing that you are most proud of.
We just read it.
I don't know.
What else is there to talk about? Like, I feel like...
No, you're right, because it's empty. You're right. It is an empty film. There is nothing in here. At least the first one, it was so dense with the stuff we didn't care about. They kept on throwing more and more crap at the wall, just seeing what fits, that we at least had something to talk about for over 2 hours. But you're right. This one is... It's a long fight scene in a place where... The characters are not expanded upon anymore, and honest to God, there's nothing worth giving the time to.
Right, here's the thing. You can describe this whole movie as follows, right? Velen from the first movie is alive. They're coming to the planet. The people on the planet have 5 days to prepare by farming and training to fight. Once they get there, they fight for the rest of the movie. The end.
Sequel hook.
Sequel bait at the end, where it's like, oh, we're going to go find the princess, and everyone's aligned with Korra to go and save the universe by finding the princess. And it's like, okay, I guess we've got that goal. And it just makes me wonder, what is the next one going to be ripping off? Actually, that reminds me, there's a shot in this. It's funny, actually, that we compared in the first movie to Tarik jumping on the animal, kind of like Avatar, because there's a shot in this that is taken straight from Avatar. It's when one of the villagers is like, he jumps onto one of the little ships, and he's like fighting on the back of the ship, and it's like still open at the back with the drop down like ramp.
Oh yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he gets killed, and he rolls off the ramp, and then falls to his death. That shot is exactly an Avatar with one of the Na'vi in the big third act final fight scene.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, so I just, you know,
honestly, we didn't even talk about that guy like at all.
Hold on, to say about him. What was there to say?
He was one of the few named characters from the first movie. They gave him a whole little thing of he's the best hunter, and he's got a love interest with Korra.
It But he doesn't do anything. He just stands around and just nods when he's agreeing with like what they're saying, and that's about it. He jumps into a thing and tries to like fight them. That's it. Like that's his entire thing. There's nothing to say about him.
Yeah. But that's kind of what the point I want to make is that for all of the stuff they set up in the first movie, they deliver on practically none of it. And that's just the saddest part of this whole thing, is that they split it into two parts and they still couldn't deliver on anything.
I don't even remember what they set up in the first movie for him. I didn't remember him from the first movie.
I mean, to be fair, he wasn't around for most of the movie, but he was named and he did get to have sex with Korra. So that's his character.
Oh, I really don't remember that.
All right. So if we're doing ratings here, I mean, I gave the first one a 3. I think this one is worse. I'm not going to say by much, but it is definitely a lot less happening. And I feel like it betrays the core concept of what I think Rebel Moon was pitched to us as, which is check out this new universe we made and we're going to love playing in it, because this movie has nothing to do with the universe they made. It's just the consequence of the first movie existing. And it feels like a consequence. It's not a privilege this happens. This is, we misbehaved and we were punished for it. So I think that overall, this one's going to be a 2.5.
There's no consequences in the actual movie, but the movie itself is a consequence.
Yes, absolutely.
I am going to go 3 again. I give 3 at the last one. I don't think there's that much of a difference overall. There's some things that are less tedious, some things that are more tedious, but by and large the quality overall is the same. It was painful to get through in that it's really hard to pay attention to, but at a certain point, and then there's a sort of flip where I'm realizing, oh yeah, there's like no depth to any of this, and I'm not going to like there's so little happening at points because it's just something in slow motion like moving across the screen that there's almost nothing to miss for large stretches of time. So
there was a point I made myself some breakfast, and I had it on my phone as I was walking around the kitchen, and I had to set it down as I was getting something out of the oven. And I missed probably about 30 seconds, and I said, oh, well, what did I miss? And I went back and I rewound it for those 30 seconds, and it was just 2 slow motion shots of Titus getting the water out of the barrel and sipping on it. That's all I missed. And I was like, I'm not rewinding anymore. I don't think it's worth it.
Oh dear, yeah, it's rough. So
yep,
there you go. That's the ratings. So obviously David at the end of the show does his homework, but just before that, I'll just tell you all about Patreon. There's a couple of bonus shows that me and David do every month. We do extra reels where we watch some of the worst movies ever made, so hopefully so bad they're good. If this wasn't such a high profile new release, it might have ended up in extra reels one day, but alas, it's on the ace. So here it is. We also do the Criterion Cup, which is movies from the Criterion Collection. So both those shows are once per month. So a bit more variety to the movies we cover on top of Ace and Collector's Cut. So do check them out if you want to support the content and help keep it all coming, help keep the lights on, all that stuff. It's super helpful if you do. Also, next week, I should probably tell you what's coming next week as well. Something better than this, I'm sure. Well... First of all, having Rebel Moon Part 2 and Star Wars Episode 1 The Phantom Menace back-to-back is a sick, cruel joke. The only thing that doesn't feel too bad is that we already recorded Phantom Menace, so I don't have to worry about watching it now. I've already done it. It's done. It's in the can. It's recorded. I don't have to care. But that is a hell of a back-to-back. Holy shit.
And plus, last week it was Prometheus.
Just to fancy that. 2 movies in a row that are pretending to be Star Wars.
Perfect. Some would argue 3.
I wouldn't say... I mean, it's a prequel, but it's not pretending to be Star Wars.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
I wouldn't go that far. But yeah, so yeah, Phantom Menace is next week because it's May the 4th, plus it's also the anniversary of Phantom Menace, 25th anniversary, because, I'm just going to die soon, apparently, because it's been 25 years since Phantom Menace. All right, David does a homework movie where he goes back and watches a sci-fi film that me and Tara did on the show before he joined, so that he can get caught up and have the whole lineage. What did you pick for this week, David?
Well, I was thinking about it, and I was thinking, all right, this is a whole new universe. It's building up on things that I'm unfamiliar with, and therefore it can do whatever it wants. And I decided to go with episode 167, which is Flash Gordon. Because
Flash.
I thought, yep, I thought, you know, I don't know if I'm going to like Flash Gordon. You did not rate it that highly. Tara gave it a little bit better than that. But I went into it thinking, at the very least, comparing it to Rebel Moon, it's going to be more fun, you know?
Mm.
And wholesale, it was. It absolutely was. It was stupid the whole way through. It was just like, it's obviously that period of the 80s where they were kind of hearkening back to a lot of 50s stuff going on, because it felt like it had a lot of 50s flair to the way that it was presented.
I would go further back. It's more movie serials of like the 30s and 40s, but I see what you're saying.
And but like they used modern effects and stuff like that, as modern as cheap 80s can be. But no, it was just stupid fun the whole time. Like the whole way through, the cast was honestly more stacked than I imagined it would be. Timothy Dalton and Brian Blessed both showing up in some pretty major roles there was shocking, along with Max von Sydow as the main villain. So
look, it's better than Rebel Moon, I'll give you that.
Yes, absolutely.
I'll happily say it.
All in all, it was a fun time the whole way through. I wouldn't say that, you know, it's high art. I don't think that there's any surprise in the fact that we haven't gotten a Flash Gordon sequel, or it didn't reignite the Flash Gordon like passion of the 80s.
There was a TV show in the early 2000s.
Yep, I saw that. And I mean, not the show, but The Witcher.
No, I never saw the show. I just remember the billboard, which looked very CW, but the billboard, the slogan on it was, only one Gordon can save us now, and I did think that was a funny tagline.
That's such a weird... who's the other Gordon? Is it a Half-Life thing? Is that what we were talking about?
No, because it's like, because normally that sentence would be only one man can save us now, you know? Like,
yeah.
It's like Doc at the end of Back to the Future, or Marty, I should say, at the end of Back to the Future Part 2, where he's like, only one man can save me now. That's what they're basically saying, but
gotcha.
They swapped out man with Gordon, and that's kind of funny to me that, you know, there's maybe, what, 10,000 Gordons on planet Earth? I don't know how many, if that's too many or what, but there's one Gordon who's special.
Flash.
And he wears a leather jacket.
Ah.
On the billboard, yeah. He did, at least. I assume that's what he's...
Nah, I don't think he ever does in this.
Oh, no, yeah, not in the movie. No, in the movie, he's got that... It's like a jumpsuit kind of thing he's wearing.
He's got a t-shirt with his own name on it for like half the movie. And then the other half the movie is a lightning bolt. And I'm just thinking, damn, man, your branding is on point. Good job. But no, overall, I did enjoy myself at least a hell of a lot more than I did with Rebel Moon. It's stupid. It's lighthearted. It's not something you need to take super seriously. I'd say it's probably a solid 6.5 for me. I'm not going to bump it up to 7 because I do think that's where you have to actually start talking about, like, it has something to say or it has some real quality to it. And it's just stupid fun.
Yeah. I remember being bored as parts, but I also remember the villain lady being super horny all the time.
Oh, all the time.
Yeah.
100%.
So, all right. Well, there you go.
I love there was a telepathic communication at one point as she's just making out with Flash, and Flash just can't help but thinking, like, damn, this girl's really got me going. And the person on the other end of telepathic communication is like, I'm sorry, what, Flash? Huh? What was that? She's like, nothing. Mm-hmm. Bye.
Oh, well, there you go. That's David's homework for another week. That has been Rebel Moon Part 2. Did we really go 2 hours in the first one?
Yeah, but well over 2 hours.
Damn, okay. Yeah, there was a lot more to talk about with that one. I'm sure Part 3, if it happens, and I hope it doesn't, but if it does, I'm sure that'll be a meaty conversation. But there you go. That is our thoughts on the movie. Like I said, join us for Star Wars Episode 1, The Phantom Menace next week. A lot of heavy hitters recently between this, Prometheus, Phantom Menace, Back to the Future, wrapping up the Apes trilogy. A lot of big titles on Ace over this month and next. But let us know what you think of the movie in the comments. Like, subscribe, all that stuff. Helps out a bunch if you do. And of course, go to Patreon, like we said. But otherwise, that is us. So thank you once again for watching or listening. We always appreciate it. Keep watching science fiction and computer at Salsa.